Hello everyone, hello football fans around the world. Welcome to the Squawker Talker. My name is Nick English and this week we have a very special interview with David Sumpter, Professor of Applied Maths at Uppsala University. He's written a book called Soccermatics. It's out today. It's a really good read and it talks a little bit about the mathematics behind the structure of football. I caught up with him earlier to talk a little bit about his book and his passion for the game. So, David, thanks very much for joining us. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on.
Well, it's really fun to be here.
Hopefully it is. Reading Soccermatics, I love the book. I really enjoyed it. I'm a bit of a maths geek. I really, really enjoyed it. It's really relatable. It's well written. It's clear to see that you love football. How did you come to fall in love with the game? I mean, what was the sort of, you know, genesis of your adoration of this sport?
I mean, actually, it's relatively recently. So I always, like everyone else, I watched football, I played with my friends and so on. But then my son turned out to be a pretty good football player and I ended up coaching his team. And it was really then that I really got excited about football. Because my own research, well, if you've read the book, you'll find out my own research is about animal groups and how they behave in groups. And suddenly I was out on the football pitch and looking at these kids running around. And I started to think, well, what's the patterns? What's the patterns that lie behind these kids' movements? And can this actually scale up to full football matches? So I kind of got my excitement through the coaching and the matches. And then I started to look at football in a completely different way.
So, I mean, what position does your son play? Have you sort of tried to use...
They play everywhere in our club. So they're 10, and we try not to have too many of this position stuff. So he actually plays a lot of goalkeeper, despite the fact that he's quite short. I don't think you'll like me saying that on air, but he plays a lot of goalkeeper, and we encourage them to play a lot of passing, even as goalkeeper. And we try and play them in all different positions.
And how has your research sort of affected just even, I mean, what is it like, how old is he? How old is the team?
They're 10 now. So I started with them when they were 7. They're 10, 11 now.
How has your research sort of affected like how they coach and their performances? I mean, do you see changes? Do you see like affectations from it?
I think there's some impact of it. I mean, we're a bunch of coaches, so I'm not the only one. But I do things like, I've always talked to them, even when they were younger, about triangles, that you want to create triangles on the pitch. And then I do these types of passing networks. So the passing networks I do in the book and so on, I write them out during the match for the kids. And then I show them, you know, there's been lots of passes here between these two players. Mm-hmm. And that really encourages them to play like 2-3 touch football. We say at the end of the match, it's not the one that scores the most goals. It's the one that's done the most passes during, most forward passes maybe, or I don't know, most passes that you've managed to do during the match. That's what we're going to say, you know, you're the two best players of the match and so on. So I think it has actually had an impact on the way that I train football and the way I see it.
So, I mean, talk to us a little bit about you mentioned triangles there. Talk to us about the importance of triangles. I mean, it's something that's been in football tactics for years and years, is make triangles. Why are triangles so important in football when you're trying to move the ball around? I mean, from a mathematical perspective.
Yeah, so there's a coupling between creating triangles and creating space. And that was the first thing I found when I started looking at the data. So I started, of course, with the most mathematically beautiful team, Barcelona, from 2010-11. And I looked, what are they doing? And what they're doing when they attack is they just go and stand in the middle of all the players. So if they're attacking the attackers will stand in the middle of all the defensive players of the opposition. And just through that, if everybody does that, you'll create all these beautiful triangles which allow you to pass the ball through the other team. And that, I suppose that's the sort of tiki-taka style of football, as it was called then. And that's just completely coupled to the creation of triangles.
Interesting. You talk about it very early in the book, the concept of predictions and predictive analysis in football. How do you weigh up being a football fan and, you know, loving the magic of the game? And you talk quite romantically about the magic of the game.
Yeah.
Who do you support?
I'm a Liverpool fan.
All right, so yeah, there's a lot of magic.
So you've got to be a romantic, really, keep...
A huge game tonight as well.
Yeah, no, exactly. So, I mean, there's so much... Yeah, and when you're a fan, you know, you stop seeing it in that kind of analytical way. You just start to enjoy the game. And I really think that that's important. I think I tried to talk about how there's sort of three aspects in football. There's the randomness and there's the luck. There's a lot of that in football. There's the structure of the game, like I've just talked about with the passing triangles. And then there is just this way that this magic, the way we love watching the game. In the book, I describe the goal that Zlatan scored against England a couple of years back, and watching that with my family. And just the reaction that people have to that type of thing. And you'll never be able to totally break down and analyze that type of that type of magic. I don't think we want to do that. We don't want to take the magic out of football.
Yeah, I mean, related to exactly to what you're talking about, whenever I talk about my job with anyone, you know, I work for a football stats website, you know, I'm always told, oh, you do Moneyball. You must get that a lot.
I think one of my positions really is that it's not just about numbers. So especially football, football is about structure and mathematics is about structure. And so what you're doing with mathematics is you're trying to describe the structure of the game and even the beauty of the game, not just using numbers like key stats. How far a player has run isn't really the most important thing in a football match. Uh-huh. It's how the players are using space and how they're creating chances.
And I mean, why do you think that nobody's been able to replicate a sort of Moneyball approach in football? I mean, is it to do with how the transfers work? Is it to do with you know, the financial aspect of the game and the you know, almost the financial doping which happens? Is it to do with the actual structure of the sport itself as an actual game? I mean, why do you think we're not able to carry that on in football to the same degree as maybe they did in baseball?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely down to the structure of the game. So in baseball, I mean, I'm not a big baseball fan, so I don't want to say something insulting to baseball just now.
I'll say something insulting. It's the most boring sport I've ever watched.
Well, I mean, what happens in baseball is someone throws the ball either well or badly, and someone hits the ball either well or badly, and you can just collect up a load of statistics about how well or badly they've done. And then you can know if you've got a good player or a bad player. In football, it's a much more complicated thing. I always say it's more than the sum of the parts. So every player is contributing something, and it's how they play together as a team. So now, of course, they're talking about Mahrez is going to leave Leicester, maybe, and they're going to take him out and put him in some other team. And yeah, I mean, maybe that's going to work, but maybe it's not. It's very difficult to know if you take a part out of that team and put it into a part of another team, if it's actually going to have the same performance. So that's the problem I've described there. The solution is much, much more complicated.
Yeah.
And I think that will come through time. What my own research has done, we've been looking at fish groups and we've been looking at bird flocks and so on. And we had the sort of same problem. We wanted to know how this group comes out of the sum of its parts. And we've got a pretty good idea of how that works just now. And I think over time, we'll probably be able to do the same sort of thing to football, understanding synchronization in defense, understanding these passing triangles and so on.
How important do you think, you mentioned synchronization in defense and the sort of that communication on the pitch was so important. You know, how do you think that, so maths and statistics has been quite useful at analyzing, you know, sort of post-game, what players should be doing on the ball. How much do you think mathematics can inform players on the pitch in terms of affecting how they communicate and how they space themselves? Do you think there's another step to be taken in that direction and maths can be play a part in that?
Yeah, absolutely. Now there is data of pretty much what every player does on the pitch, how the player is moving, how they're using space. So the simple example is synchronization in an offside trap. I think actually we saw a bad example of that last night with Manchester City.
Yeah.
So you can measure, there was an obvious case of not following the offside trap. But what you could actually do is look at a very micro level to see who's leading the offside trap, who's managing to keep it best, and who's lagging behind.
You talk in several chapters about anomalies in football, you know, sort of explaining these anomalies. I think one of the biggest anomalies in football, if not the biggest ever, has happened this week in terms of Leicester City winning the title.
Yeah.
How does this rank in terms of anomalies? How do you account for this, either, you know, in terms of, you know, as a statistical anomaly? And what is the likelihood of this being able to be replicated?
Yeah, so I haven't done the exact calculation, but the bookmakers who set 1 in 5,000, I don't know what they were thinking. That was a very, very bad estimate. That says that once every 5,000 years, you would expect a team to like Leicester to win the league. And of course, they're going to win more often. Something like that is going to happen more often than that. That was a very bad estimate. I'd say that it's, yeah, now I'm just taking the magic out of Leicester's victory, but I would say it's a 1 in 100 type of event.
Mm-hmm.
But also what I say in the book, because I talk a little bit about Messi and how he's basically a once in a lifetime player when he scored 50 goals in La Liga in a season. This was unheard of. And although although there are players who are up there just now. I think Suarez is up there. He's not near 50, and I don't think he's going to get 50 this season. So these things do happen, but there's also this concept of this game-changer thing. So when you have an event like Messi or Leicester, it's very possible that they've actually changed what's going to happen. And next season, we'll see maybe Leicester do it again, or we'll see another team do it again. So I certainly wouldn't go for 1 in 100 either now. Now we've seen it happen, we know that there's a better chance that it can happen again.
You mentioned game changers, and you use a very good example, actually. Mm. It's very well explained in the book in terms of how Usain Bolt was a game changer. Well, basically, he's either a total freak and a once in a millennial sprinter, or he's, you know, a total game changer. Do you think football still can experience these kind of breakthroughs, and something like Leicester City or Messi is a contributing factor to that?
Yeah, no, I think we're always going to see that. That's what makes it so exciting. What maths can do really is analyze what we've seen before. It's not so good at saying what we're going to see in the future. So I did some tactical analysis of Leicester this season, mm-hmm. and showed that they did very successful direct ball passing. And I've done analysis of Barcelona and Bayern, and done analysis of these different teams. But what I can't really do is say from this analysis what's going to be the thing that's beating them next season. Mm-hmm. That's sort of where the genius of the managerial genius lies. You know, that's where I'm sure all the managers are thinking of plans of how they're going to do it. And yeah, I'll probably be after them trying to analyze it. I'm not going to say that I'm going to be the person to find that secret.
And you mentioned you've done some analysis on Leicester City's tactics. Do they fit in with, you talk in the book about a concept called a cyber dynamo,
yeah,
which sounds awesome. But do Leicester fit in that category of teams?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they do. It's
can you explain the cyber dynamo concept?
Right. So what I'm thinking about there is it comes down to this being more than the sum of your parts again. Mm-hmm. That if everybody's doing their job and everybody's agreed on the plan, then together, the communication's working and you can lift the team up, and you can often lift the team up a lot. And this is, in mathematics, we call this that is non-linear. A linear means that as you add one part to the system, the efficiency of the system increases. But if it's non-linear, if it's super-linear, then each part you add to the system, it just becomes more and more effective. And that's what I describe. I describe it for total football, the Dutch style of football. And I also describe it for Dynamo Kiev as well, how they played football in the 80s. Mm. And I think Leicester probably have that. I am not one of the people who are going to attribute Leicester being lucky. They have built up more than some of their parts. The way, if you think about how Albrighton and Vardy communicate with each other, or don't even need to talk to each other to know where each other are going to be on the pitch, that's being more than some of the parts. That's the cyber dynamo aspect of it.
You mentioned in the book you're Scottish.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not Scottish, actually.
You're not Scottish.
No, I was born in London, I grew up in Scotland.
Ah, okay.
So
okay.
Yeah, you can hear that I'm not exactly
not quite,
the strongest.
Yeah, well, I was going to say before I was going to explain to the listeners that they might be a little bit confused.
No, I grew up as a sort of the only English person in my school.
Oh, right, okay. That must have been stressful.
That was interesting.
But now you can understand perfect Scotch, which is
yes,
you know,
exactly. I understand the language, of course, but I can't speak it.
So when you were a kid, did you go to a lot of games? I mean, did you visit often? Where were you based?
Yeah, it was Dunfermline. So Dunfermline Athletic is my home team. And I describe a little bit in the book watching the game with my dad. My dad he enjoys going to the football, but he sort of sits in the home end and is kind of very neutral in his support for the teams. He doesn't get too excited about it. So I'd sit next to him, and he didn't really understand what all the fuss was about. So he was, I suppose I have some of that logical analysis.
Well. So you credit Jimmy Hill with being one of the revolutionary figures in football, despite being rather unpopular.
Scotland. Can I tell her? I don't know if I should tell this story on air, but you can cut it later if it doesn't.
Okay, yeah, we'll see how it goes.
So Jimmy Hill really, of course, you know, he died recently, and that's of course sad, but he has a very special role in Scotland, and people really did not like Jimmy Hill during the 1980s. It came down to the way he described Scotland's first goal against Brazil as a toe poke. And that was not popular with anybody in Scotland.
I can imagine.
And then I remember one time I went to a concert, and it was The Farm playing in the 1990s in Glasgow Barrowlands, and they started putting up on the screen all these pictures of football players, and this is something you really shouldn't do in Glasgow. You know, there's all the Celtic and Rangers fans, and they're sort of little bit of aggression between each other, and it was starting up with a few sort of different Celtic Rangers songs, and it was getting a sort of not very good atmosphere in there. But then suddenly this picture came up of Jimmy Hill on the screen, and all in unison, everybody started singing, "We all hate Jimmy Hill, he's a..." And I'm not going to say what they said, but and that was just a beautiful moment of unison about Jimmy Hill.
Takes a lot to unite Scottish football fans.
Yeah, exactly.
Archie Gemmell and Jimmy Hill have both done it separately.
So I don't cover that story in the book. But yeah, Jimmy Hill. So, but then for a mathematician as me, I actually really, really do appreciate Jimmy Hill, because he came up with this idea of 3 points for a win. And that works extremely well. When it was 2 points for a win, basically what you're doing is you're fighting over the same pie, and you shouldn't really bother fighting. You can just split the pie and take one point home each. And when he introduced the 3 points for a win, then suddenly there's this sort of supersized pie that as soon as you finish the match and you've won, it's grown and you can take home one extra big pie yourself. And that's what teams should do. So I do a kind of proof in the book of how you should think as a manager. And as long as you think your team is half as good as the opposition, you should go all out for the win. And I think most Premier League teams, at least they hope that they're half as good as even the best top Premier League teams. And that makes it a much more competitive game.
So essentially you're turning what is a 2 point pie into a 3 point pie.
Yeah, a 2 point pie is like, it's a normal pie. It's a pie that you can share. If you share it, you get 1 point each. A 3 point pie is, well, you can't really. You if you share it, then you only get one each. And actually, but if you take home the whole thing, you get three. So it becomes this sort of expanding pie. If you win, you get part of this expanding pie. And that gives you the extra edge. That gives you the extra incentive.
It's really interesting dynamic that I doubt, I mean, no disrespect to Jimmy Hill, but did you think he understood what he was doing from a mathematical point of view? Or did he just think logically there's more incentive?
I don't know that he did the actual proof of this. But sometimes mathematics isn't about that. I think it's not... it's not fair for me as a mathematician to come in and take the credit for that. He thought up the idea, and I kind of just demonstrated more rigorously why it's true. So I think he understood a lot of that thing.
You work at the University of Uppsala in Sweden. You're full time there.
Yeah.
How long have you been there?
Yes, I moved to Sweden 10, 12 years ago now, and then I was back in Britain for a bit, and then I've been about 9 years based over there now.
So. And do you do all of this research in your spare time? I mean, how long does it take? All these passing networks and all of this research? I mean, it must take a fair chunk of time.
Yeah, it does. And so when I wrote the book, I basically got up early every morning and wrote and did the research. And a lot of the stuff, a lot of the techniques I use are the techniques I use in my other research. So there's been a bit of an overlap. And we have started thinking a little bit about football research as well in our research group. So most of our research just now, we have a big project on fish. And when I've done something interesting on football, I tell the fish people about it, and the fish people tell me something interesting they've been doing. And we've got quite a good flow between those types of things. So maybe we're going to be doing some football research in the future.
Oh, excellent. Sweden is football mad.
Yeah.
Obviously, the whole of Scandinavia is. They're absolutely crazy for it. Do you go to a lot of games out there?
Yeah, I've been to a few of the national games recently.
Oh, cool.
But mainly I'm going to my son's games so much. I don't know. I spend about sort of 10 hours a week standing on a football pitch, either watching the games or training them.
Is it true you put GPRS trackers
on
your son's team? They're only 10, David.
I know. They were only 9 when I did it. So, no, I think, you know, when I've had to write to the parents for permission to put GPS on the children, then I think they started to wonder, what is this?
Ooh, weirdest permission slip ever.
It didn't work out as well as we wanted. The accuracy of the GPS wasn't quite up to the job. But it's interesting to show them afterwards, you know, their movement, to allow them to think about these things. So I think it was a worthwhile exercise.
What's your, I mean, obviously, you've obviously covered a lot of football. It's apparent in the book that you're really a student of the game and you really enjoy it, both all the magic of it, the tactics of it, the the goal scoring, the defending, the leadership, every aspect of the game is something that you even talk about the crowds and how they work. Who's your favorite team to study? Who's your favorite player to study? Like, are there any ones that stick out for like strange reasons?
Yeah, there's all differences. I think it's nice to study the differences between players. I think this season, the player who I enjoyed doing the analysis on most was Coutinho.
Oh, yeah.
Because I'm a Liverpool fan, and there was a lot of stuff, you know, so then you follow Twitter and you hear that people are complaining that he's shooting too much, that he's like knocking it. And I wanted to look at him and see, was he really shooting too much? And I actually found that he was doing more passes into the box than most of the Liverpool players, more successful passes than any other Liverpool player. And he was really up there with Christian Eriksen. He wasn't going to compete with Ozil. So he was actually doing his passes into the box, and he was also getting those shots off with a relative success rate. So I really enjoyed doing that because he's a player I like watching, and I was a bit worried that it was maybe true that he was sort of wasting these chances, so he wasn't a kind of analytics player. But it turned out that he is actually statistically on the ball as well as being a fun player to watch.
Interesting. We talk about Coutinho quite a lot in the office because he is one of these players that seems to blow hot and cold, and it is frustrating to watch. But he's capable of really great things with the ball. I mean, do you think he'll be able to? I mean, young players, it's always hard to tell whether they become consistent or not. Mm. I mean, you know, what does your gut tell you?
That is difficult to know if he's going to become consistent, but I can see his frustration because, you know, he's trying to pass into the box and nobody was finishing for half the season. You know, Sturridge is back now, so maybe it's going to be better next season. But that's the problem. If you're passing into the box and you're doing everything right in terms of that, then you should actually be allowed to have a odd blast over the bar just to chance it.
Have you got any predictions for the upcoming season or seasons or the immediate future, or something that you, in your research, that you've spotted that you think, that's interesting, that could develop into something which we need to keep an eye on in the next couple of years?
Yeah, that's a really difficult one. I think I've said a few times about how tactics evolve, how we've seen this season is the Arsenal strategy of getting the ball into the box and trying for high expected goals like they've been doing hasn't quite worked out. And Leicester have got another strategy. So I think we are going to see people copying Leicester. But whether that's going to be successful or not is really, really difficult to say. I mean, one classic example is West Ham have had a good season, but I think everyone knows that they've been reasonably lucky. Are they going to start playing in a more Leicester style? They have Payet, and maybe he's going to start playing like Mahrez on the other wing. It's difficult to know.
Yeah, Leicester, obviously, you know, a lot of people are saying that they won't be able to sustain their sort of pressing game over a full season if they, you know, get successful in the Cups and they have the European campaign. There's a lot of focus on pressing at the moment. Everybody's, you know, obsessed with it. Do you think we'll be, you know, Guardiola, Klopp, Simeone, they base their whole philosophy, you know, seemingly around it. Is it the one great sort of hole we have in terms of data, is understanding, you know, pressing data and how it works and how it affects football games?
Yeah, that's very true that it's difficult to get in terms of data because you can't really see it. You can see if they're doing it successfully or not. And I did some analysis looking again at Liverpool. I did some analysis of where Liverpool were getting the ball back before before Klopp took over. And you can actually see that. But really, for pressing is something which you have to do as a whole team. So you have to know where all the players are. The data exists to do this type of stuff. I'm not sure that the clubs are analysing it properly in the way that I would like to analyse it.
That's interesting.
I think the data exists, so it would be possible to see how successful it is. But we'll see.
I think you've just pricked up the ears of every football analytics community member who works for a football club.
Yes.
All five of them who will listen to this. Squawk has been around for about 4 years now, and over that time, you know, we take a very visual sort of approach to football data, and we've seen data really enter the public consciousness and, you know, enter the football fans' thinking, whereas previously it was very much American sports which were more statistically focused. What do you think for the future is for data and football, and also the sort of like mathematical approach that you take? That sort of, do you think those sort of approaches, you know, looking at passing networks, looking at logic based structures, you know, paths for balls, and you know, space is? Do you think, where do you think those are going to go next? What do you think the future is?
Well, I mean, first of all, I'd love to see the type of stuff that I do on the Soccermatics Twitter account, for example. Mm. I'd love to see that used more widely. I don't have any copy. I'm an academic, so I work at a university, so I think everything I do is publicly owned. So you guys could, I think, well, I don't know if you guys could just go and steal what I've done, but I'd love to see more of these types of passing networks which show what happened during the game. And of course, I like the expected goals maps that Michael Cayley does. They're really nice. But I think the structure of the game is what football's all around. Mm-hmm. So passing networks, these flow diagrams, heat maps, which actually show where you've been passing the ball from. I'd love to see those. And then moving on, well, definitely that you could actually, the data is there that you could actually show where all the players were during a whole match. You could actually look and recreate the entire movement of all of the players. You can summarize it all. I think there's a big future for the data community in football.
Fantastic. The book is Soccermatics. It's out now on Bloomsbury Hardback. Mm-hmm. David Sumpter, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. That was lots of fun.
Thanks. Yeah, was it good fun? Brilliant. Yeah, we like to have fun in our podcast room. So Soccermatics out now, Bloomsbury Hardback. Buy 5 copies and David will be happy. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Must be 18+. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.